This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Welcome to the program. We have for you today two of the most compelling interviews we've ever recorded for this show. Our first segment will concern ourselves with the story of Vicky and Bill Wilson. In 1994, Bill and Vicky discovered that their one-month-from-being-born child had anatomic defects so severe that she could not possibly survive the birth process. Their difficult decision to obtain a third trimester abortion and the aftermath of that event will occupy our first segment today. Legislation to ban what anti-abortion forces have labeled the partial birth abortion is certain to be signed into law by George Bush soon. I think we need to devote ourselves to an extended interview on this important topic, and I can assure you that you will find Vicky and Bill's story compelling listening. In our second segment today, we're pleased to have an interview recorded last Friday with investigative reporter Greg Pallast. Pallast's book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, is currently number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list and is at present the best-selling book on American college campuses. Now, we also had a chance to hear Edward O. Wilson, one of the most influential American biologists, scientists of recent decades, and we're keen to report on E.O. Wilson's talk given at the Mondavi Center, as well as finishing up on telling you about our trip to Alaska to witness the Aurora Borealis. But that must be deferred to next week's program. So let us also defer Greg Pallast for a segment and take up our interview with Vicky Wilson, a registered nurse, and husband Bill, an emergency room physician. Vicky has told this story to Ed Bradley and appeared on 60 Minutes. It has also been written about in the San Jose Mercury News, Rolling Stone Magazine, Salon.com, and she has testified before the Congress of the United States. This is a story we think you should hear. And we should point out that Vicky is a practicing Catholic. But as she and Bill state in this interview, in the course of making what was an agonizing decision, it never occurred to them to confer with a lawyer, judge, or congressman. Vicky, can you start with your pregnancy in 1994?
In 1994, our planned third pregnancy, all the prenatal testing had come back normal that we had had. In my 8th month, I went in for a routine prenatal visit. The physician felt at that time that my size. He wanted an ultrasound for the size to date. So they did that.
Which was probably less routine then than it is, say, now.
Oh, most definitely. I hadn't had an ultrasound up to that point. And it was kind of exciting because that particular year, my due date was May 8th, which was Mother's Day. And this was probably April 6th that I was in for the ultrasound. And my mother and my sister were in the room with me and the baby. The technician was all bubbly and, oh, here are the baby's feet. And when she got to the head, she was really, really quiet and then just said, you know, I'll be right back. And she came back in and had my sister and my mom leave and said, you need to go in and get your clothes on and go see the doctor. And so right away I knew, okay, something's up. Went into his office and he shows me the ultrasound and he shows me basically two circles. He said, see this circle? Yes, well, that's her head. And then there was another circle next to that and he said, that's her brain. And I just sort of collapsed. The medicine end of me, the objective went way out, and I said, well, let's just put the brain back into the head and take care of it that way. And he's like, Vicky, this is a flawed pregnancy. We need to figure out, you know, what to do from here. What do you want to do? And I said, well, what do I want to do? What are my options? And he said, well, you can go ahead and just let nature take its course and go into, you know, labor. We don't know when that's going to be. I said, well, let's do a C-section and get her out now and try to save her. And he repeatedly, you know, we can't save her. You're my patient at this point, and we need to figure out what's best for you. And we were sent to actually a perinatologist radiologist. So we ended up with three scenarios, three options. One was to go ahead with the delivery, and that would be like we didn't know when. The next was, I thought, actually a C-section, and that's when my OB said, well, we do C-sections, you know, to save babies' lives, and we can't save her, and I can't justify doing that surgery. Right. And even if I did, I can't tell you what the hospital politics would be with what they would do with the baby. Or you can think about terminating the pregnancy. And I looked at him and said, what do you mean terminate? An abortion? I had never even heard of an abortion in the eighth month of pregnancy. And here I am in the medical field.
My feelings too was, okay, how can we keep her alive? And Vicky had said to me, if she could stay pregnant for the rest of her life to keep her alive, she would have. It was about ending her suffering. In fact, all this time leading up to this ultrasound, we'd been feeling these really strong kicking at night over and over again. They're repetitive. Like we thought, oh, this is just a really strong baby. Well, it turns out her head being so malformed was stuck in one corner of Vicky's uterus, and these kicking we're feeling were seizures. So this baby was seizing inside her and was already dying.
Which would pretty much necessitate brain damage in the process.
Oh, yeah. This baby would not have survived a birth to the vaginal canal anyway. And the brain was bleeding because there was nothing protecting it.
Right.
And so really, our decisions had to do with ending our baby's suffering because our baby was suffering and we didn't want to suffer anymore.
And he said, well, we can't do it here. They then knew of three physicians nationally that we could go to. We could either go to Dr. Warren Hearn, who, from what I understand, basically wrote the book on abortion, and he was in Boulder, Colorado. There was Dr. McMahon, who helped pioneer the intact DNA, and he was in L.A. And then there was another physician, and his name eludes me right now, in Kansas City. And those were the three options in terms of going to a physician and talking about terminating the pregnancy. Well, we chose L.A. because of its proximity, and just logistically it was easier for us to go there.
So we might want to clarify that with all the politics and talk of this procedure, that it really is a very small number of places where it can be done.
That's correct. Three places that the genetics people here in the Valley knew about.
So you spoke to them in L.A. about it, and...
And then Bill called, it's called Eve's Surgical Center, where we went, Dr. McMahon's clinic. And Bill got on the phone to talk with him and ended up talking to his partner. And explained to Bill, because Bill was a physician, you know, I think explained a little bit more in detail, you know, what was involved. But the clinic itself was absolutely amazing to me. You know, in an extremely tragic, I mean, here I had already had a shower. We had already had the nursery ready, you know, the crib was up. All we were missing was the baby. And so here we are, rather than deciding, you know, names and just the joy of bringing a new baby home, we get to decide when the baby's going to die.
What happened next?
After talking with Dr. McMahon's nurse, and she pretty much explained that the procedure would take 3 days because I was so far along, and we were treated as if we were the only people in the whole world that were going through this, which was amazing to me because that's how we felt. The compassion that they showed was just incredible. Prior to all of this, I was, I would say, very apolitical. I've always been pro-choice, but never actively so. I was afraid to go to this clinic because here, you know, I had visions of protesters and signs, and here I was huge. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, how are we going to, you know, Bill, we need to prepare ourselves for, you know, what it's going to feel like to go through a picket line. And to our amazement, this place was like an oasis. There were no picketers. There were no protesters.
One of the reasons why we decided to do this procedure, intact DNA, is that the initial genetic testing was normal. So why this happened, we didn't know. And if we did the other type procedure to extract the baby, where they destroy the baby in the process, we wouldn't be able to tell whether there was anything, whether this was a fluke or anything else like genetic going on with the baby without getting the baby out intact.
Explain what intact DNA is, what that stands for.
What it stands for is that the baby is brought out of the uterus in one piece without dismemberment or destruction of the baby.
Right, which in some cases I gather is not possible.
Yes.
That's correct, which is interesting because the actual procedure is called an intact dilation and evacuation, as opposed to just the regular dilation and evacuation extraction of a termination.
You meant dilation and extraction.
That's correct. And this, you know, so-called partial birth abortion, which is, you know, there's no medical definition for that. It's not in any medical books. It's very difficult to define what they're talking about. So as best that the medical community could make of this was that they were talking about an intact DNA because of the pictures they were showing of the perfect little babies. And it was always interesting how they would show, they being the antis, they would just show a uterus with a perfect looking baby in it to give you the impression that these abortions are being done on perfectly healthy babies and taking the woman totally out of the picture and really truly, you know, distort what truly is going on.
2 points I maybe want to clarify that, you know, in the wake of Roe v. Wade, it was ruled that the state had an interest in the fetus in the third trimester, that it could not be considered a person in the first trimester, and the second, and the middle trimester was somewhere in between. So by definition, even per Roe v. Wade, this is in an area where the fetus is considered viable and in essence a person.
Yes, a third trimester abortion is illegal unless the health or life of the mother or child is in danger.
Right.
You can't just do an abortion in the third trimester just because you want an abortion.
Exactly.
That's not an option.
Right. And here's part of the, I think, the political cleverness of this bill is you're clouding, again, two issues. Yes, the second trimester is protected under Roe v. Wade, but we're clouding the intact DNE or partial birth abortion that's used in the second trimester as well as third trimester. If a physician feels that an intact DNE would work in the second trimester, then it's used. This bill doesn't prevent a third trimester abortion, which is already illegal, but it does prevent the safest, which is the intact DNA, which can be interpreted as being the partial birth abortion procedure. You know, when they tell you, oh, there's many more of these intact DNAs being done than what's purported to be, yes, in the second trimester, which is still legal. It's the third trimester that we're talking about that I had. And so that's when, back when I was lobbying in Washington, it was stated that there are very few of these being done. You know, the Alan Guttmacher Institute said there were maybe 400 to 600 a year. And then there were some numbers coming up in the thousands. Well, yes, that was the second trimester. Very little of these procedures are done in the third trimester. But this procedure can also be used in the second trimester, which is still protect. You know, you can do that under Roe v. Wade.
The intact DNA allowed us to get this baby out so we could study it to see whether it's likely to happen again or not,
right,
which the other procedure would not allow us to decide that or not. So doing it this way gives information about whether we ever want to get pregnant again. And in fact, after they did the morphology testing at Cedars-Sinai, it was a fluke, 1 in 10,000 fluke, and had nothing to do with our genetics or anything. It just happened. And therefore, it'd be okay for us to get pregnant again. It was not likely to ever happen to us again,
right,
which we wouldn't have known otherwise.
In dealing with this, which was probably the hardest thing I think we, Bill and I, went through, and of course this was going to involve the other two children, because they, you know, here I was 8 months pregnant, I'm going to take off now, and we told the children, well, you know, the baby's sick, and we're going to go to a special doctor that may be able to save her. And I thought, you know, somehow I want the kids involved in this, because I was kind of, you know, you're grouchy in your 8th and 9th month of pregnancy, and kids, if they don't have the truth, they make up their own, and usually that's by far worse than reality. So the intact DNA also allowed for the baby to come out whole so that we could hold her, we could say goodbye. And the other important thing was that it was the safest procedure to keep the integrity of my cervix so that I could go on to have, you know, future pregnancies if that's what we chose to do. The intact DNA for us was, I think, the most gentlest of deaths, because death was inevitable for Abigail. And so we had to choose which way she was going to die. And for us, this was the easiest for us that we could live with. And after all, that is what it's about. What can we live with?
Well, I wish we hadn't had to go through this. It wasn't something I'd ever wish on anybody.
When we were deciding this, you know, we talked to our priest. We called my mother. We called his folks. In all of the discussions, it never, ever occurred to us to call our senator or to call our congressperson and say, hey, what do you think? The fact that it's become a political issue, it's incomprehensible to me. I don't think it belongs in the political arena. It's an extremely personal tragedy that a family does go through, and I think that it should stay within the family unit. It's an already difficult tragedy to have to decide the things that we needed to decide that would work for us, and then to add in the insult of, well, is this going to be legal or not? Thank God I didn't have to think of that aspect of it.
So how long after this took place were you realizing that you may need to get more politically proactive?
In 95, we got a call from Dr. McMahon asking if we would be willing to go to Washington and tell our story, because there was a bill in the House that would basically prevent the procedure that we had done. It would be a criminal act for him to do that particular procedure. And here we are in medicine, and, you know, we're logical thinkers, and I'm thinking, well, of course I'll go to Washington and I'll tell my story, and they'll all say, oh, well, we see, and that'll be it. I'll get on a plane and come home. And what are we now? 7 years down the road, and
things have gone in quite the opposite direction.
Absolutely. And it's not about the truth. That's the hard part to deal with.
So what was it like to testify before the United States Senate?
It was intimidating to talk about something that was so personal and so tragic, and to have to try to convince someone that the choice that you made, the decision that you made, was right for you. And I found that extremely, extremely difficult. But I also felt that I needed to do it because there are going to be future pregnancies. You know, prenatal testing is not infallible. There will be future flawed pregnancies. And I just felt compelled that I needed to go to Washington, tell my story, and carry it as far as I needed to. And if the Senate was as far as I needed to go, then that's where I was headed, and I did. And I just felt it important because there will be future families that will be faced with this. And to think that one of the safest procedures available would then be illegal, I continue to do whatever I can to prevent that from happening, because I know what it's like to be there.
I understand that someone was testifying or giving Congress a contrary impression, a physician, and you had some words with him during the break.
Yes, he was talking about, you know, there are babies that are born prematurely at 8 months, 7 months, and that they're saving them. And I used to work in NICU. I know we're saving them. I've taken care of those babies. So what I did is I took a picture of Abigail after she had come out, and she is, of course, intact, but she had this huge brain sac on the outside of her skull. So I took that picture to him, and I said, how would you have saved her? Because apparently he was a neurological surgeon or a neurosurgeon. And he just looked at the picture and went, oh, well, yeah, we couldn't save her.
And so what he was saying had nothing to do with what was happening to us. It had no relevance to what was really happening and why these are being done.
Well, despite your efforts to testify before Congress, the House and Senate nevertheless passed bills to ban this procedure by 1995, leading you to lobby the president.
After it passed both houses, then the bill was going to go to Bill Clinton's desk for him to sign or not. And at that point, Wim's group started petitioning him, lobbying him, saying, this is a bad bill. What are you going to do about it?
Yes, he wanted to listen. He wanted to hear our stories. He wanted to know, you know, exactly what it was that was going on. So there were four women that actually did go and meet with the president, and that was on national news TV, and all these women had had the intact DNA. I did not go at that time because I was pregnant and was told not to fly, so I didn't. Clinton at the time was sympathetic. He got it. I mean, that was the best thing. I mean, he actually understood why we were doing this. Actually, there was at one point when a friend of mine was testifying before the House committee, and Henry Hyde was the chair at that time, And we were told that we were unfit to be mothers, that perhaps we were part of a cult, and one of our initiations was to kill our unborn child. And it was interesting because I had been interviewed in the Rolling Stone magazine, and we made mention of that, and then it was rebuked by someone in the Republican Party. So they said, well, you can go to the transcripts.
Yeah, anyone familiar with Congress knows exactly. that you do not get a verbatim transcript.
No. And so, of course, that was out. Yet, there is reference to it, though, somehow, because we were so upset. Because, you know, these are flawed pregnancies that are planned most of the time. And so to hear our pregnancies trivialized because of some political agenda, it's extremely defeating.
So there was a failure in the legislative branch. The bill was passed, but President Clinton did veto it.
That's correct. After meeting with us, talking, he vowed that he would veto that regardless of how many times it came across his desk. And luckily, it only had to come across once for him.
Well, opponents of abortion were hoping for a more receptive ear in Washington, and with the election of George Bush in 2000, it appears that they gained that. You have been working since this happened to lobby.
Right. I sort of turned from an apolitical homebody to this proactive abortion rights activist. With Bush as president now, and this bill is rumored to, he's going to be signing this, I think as you had mentioned before, May 11th, which happens to be Mother's Day, which I think is extremely poignant, grandstanding from the president's side, I think. I would love to get him in a room and discuss with him the realities of this rather than, you know, some blown out of proportion. Partial birth abortion, that's just, it's difficult to debate a fictitious entity. I would really like for him to sit down and seriously listen to the women that have gone through this and the families that have gone through this, and then tell me that he feels that making this illegal is the right thing to do. It does still allow for the typical dilation and evacuation or dilation and extraction abortion still legal. I think it's horrific. Abortion is horrific, regardless. But sometimes it's necessary. In my case, it was definitely medically necessary. In fact, one of the physicians that we did see said that if my pregnancy did continue, that I could actually ultimately lose my life. And I wasn't willing to leave my other two kids without a mother. So that's why I felt it very important, and that's why I feel important today to continue telling my story so that people can understand, hopefully, and get a grasp at what is this really about? You know, what is the reality? And why do women choose to abort in their third trimester?
Given the certainty of Bush signing this bill, is there any, what recourse would people have at this point?
First of all, how will Congress be able to implement this bill? Are they actually going to go into delivery rooms? I don't know. I think it's a scare tactic for physicians because they'll be fined, they can be jailed. But when abortion was illegal, there were physicians doing abortions. I'm not really sure. Of course, there will be appeal after appeal, and I think ultimately we'll go to the Supreme Court. And again, a political ploy. I mean, they'll wait until Sandra Day O'Connor is gone. And then who knows who will be placed in her place?
My understanding is she's really the only thing that's stopping a 5-4 vote to rescind Roe v. Wade.
Exactly. And so it'll be a slam dunk depending on who's in the Supreme Court. But ultimately, that's where it will end up, in the Supreme Court.
Do you think this is likely to send people across the border into Canada and Mexico, as was done in the old days before Roe v. Wade?
Most definitely. As difficult as it is now to get a third trimester abortion, once it does indeed become illegal, it'll be even more difficult. And again, it will be needed. It is medically necessary. There are times when it is medically necessary that a woman get a third trimester abortion. So absolutely, people will go into Canada, into Mexico.
The ones that can afford it, and the ones that can't will be damaged.
And women will, once again, die.
Unnecessarily.
Absolutely.
So, Vicki, which political groups can you endorse on this issue?
Well, first of all, Most definitely NAF, National Abortion Federation. Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood Marmonte, which is our local affiliate, includes San Jose, Sacramento, Reno, most of the Central Valley, and down into Bakersfield, and then the Planned Parenthood Federation. There's also, you know, NARAL, the national level. There's also KRAL of California, even the National Women's League. And there's also a great website. It's Kaiser Network, K-A-I-S-E-R, network.org. And it's health policy as it happens, day-to-day, politically, what's going on with California as well as nationally.
One thing I would have, want everybody to tell the congressman that they do not want the government in their bedrooms and in their doctor's appointment rooms deciding what they're supposed to do with their family and what would be best for their family. I don't want the government telling me that. I want to decide that with my wife and my kids and my family what's best for us, not some government entity.
And I also think that politicians should get out of the practice of legislating medicine, because I don't think that they have the education necessary to do something like that. How does an individual get involved? I would contact your local Planned Parenthood offices, ask to speak with the public affairs director, and see if you want to volunteer. There's always something going on. That's probably the best resource in terms of how to, you know, locally get involved. And of course, there always is. People think, oh, if I call my senator, or I call my congressman, or even my assemblyman, does that really matter? Yes, it does. They count those phone calls. So it does matter. Can one person make a difference? Yes, I'm still going. I've been going 7 years on this issue. I will continue until my death. And I feel that I have made a difference. And again, it's not for me. I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for future families that will have to face this issue. So I think it's important to educate yourself. And in terms of how do you do that, listen to radio shows like this. Listen to NPR. Try to get as objective information as you can. And I think how to start is, in terms of abortion, call Planned Parenthood. People are complacent, especially the pro-choice community. You know, they sit down and they watch their MSNBC and their CNBC and they say, oh, gee, you know, that really is a shame, and the neighbor will take care of it. No, the neighbor won't take care of it. You need to take care of it. You need to get active. And I say this because I was one of those complacent people sitting saying, oh, gee, you know, that's not going to happen to me. So it is important. One vote matters. One call matters.
Well, Vicki and Bill Wilson, thanks so much for telling your story.
Thank you very much for having us. I think it's an important issue, and I really think it's important for people to be educated in terms of what the reality of this is.
You're listening to Radio Parallax. I'm your host, Douglas Everett. This is KDVS 90.3 FM. That was an interview conducted with Vicki Wilson, a registered nurse, and her husband, Bill Wilson, an emergency physician. Let's take a short break. And when we come back from the break, we'll repeat some of the names of those organizations that you may want to look up regarding reproductive health issues.